Today, we talk about food. We talk about hunger. We talk about the global food crisis. It's interesting. Over the last few weeks, we did a show on the credit crisis. We did a show on the energy crisis and now the food crisis. World food prices rose 39% in the last year. Rice alone rose to a 19-year high in March, an increase of 50% in 2 weeks alone, while the real price of wheat has hit a 28-year high. Food riots erupted in Egypt, Guinea, Haiti, Indonesia, Mauritania, Mexico, Senegal, Uzbekistan, Yemen, and since I made up that list, I've seen more countries where it's happened. For the 3 billion people in the world who subsist on $2 a day or less, the leap in food prices is a catastrophe. They spend a majority of their income on food, and when the price goes up, they can't afford to feed themselves or their families. Obvious causes: increased demand from China and India, rising fuel and fertilizer costs, increased use of biofuels, climate change. But less obvious causes have also had a profound effect on food prices. In the last 30 years, the U.S., the World Bank, and the IMF have imposed devastating policies on developing countries. By requiring them to open up their agriculture market to giant multinational companies and persuading them to specialize in exportable cash crops, they've turned developing countries that used to be self-sufficient in food into large food importers. Today's guest, Arunadha Mittal, is an expert on this crisis and its causes. We're going to try to figure out what's going on, what can be done to turn things around before they get worse. Arunadha Mittal, a native of India, is an internationally renowned expert on trade, development, human rights, and agriculture issues. After working as co-director of Food First, Institute for Food and Development Policy, Mittal established the Oakland Institute, a progressive policy think tank, in 2004. She's the author and editor of numerous articles and books, including America Needs Human Rights, The Future in the Balance, Essays on Globalization and Resistance, Sahel, A Prisoner of Starvation, and she was awarded the KPFA Peace Award in 2006. Welcome, Arunadha Mittal.
Thank you.
Okay, I want listeners to get to know a little bit about the people behind the ideas and the work that we deal with. So, you were born in India. Can you tell us just a bit about your path to the home you've chosen and the work you do today?
Definitely. As you mentioned, I was born in India in a town called Kanpur. Many of the listeners might be familiar with big cities like Delhi, Bombay, Calcutta, Madras. Kanpur is a small industrial town, which, I grew up there and went to college in Delhi. And on my way here, I stopped in England, Oxford, where I did some of my studies and came to UC Berkeley as a visiting scholar. And you mentioned the rest. I was at Food First and then started the Institute, Oakland Institute, in 2004.
And what is the mission of the Oakland Institute? Because it's broader than food and hunger.
Definitely. It's a progressive policy think tank. We work on social, economic, environmental issues which impact our lives, and our goal is to increase public participation, ensure fair debate. You could call us the Cato and Heritage Institute of the Left.
Good luck with that.
Thank you.
And the website for people who want to learn more is oaklandinstitute.org.
That's correct.
Okay. I referred in the intro to wild inflation in food prices and protest riots around the globe. This food emergency has developed in a very short space of time, essentially over the past 18 months. What's going on?
Well, actually, I would say that in terms of hunger, we have seen widespread hunger. And even before, you know, media started devoting so much, you know, time to the current crisis, prices were increasing. Even 2 years ago, Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations had pointed out that nearly 40 countries were facing food insecurity. And prices have been steadily increasing, as you pointed out. But hunger has also been increasing. Just last year, Jean Ziegler, then the rapporteur on the right to food to the United Nations, pointed out that the goal that was set in 1996 to reduce the number of hungry people by half, and it was then estimated that nearly 815 million people were food insecure, had increased to 854 million people last year. So basically, our goals to making a dent in hunger had been a failing, had become a far-fetched idea. And yes, suddenly we heard a lot about this food crisis as we saw what are being termed as food riots erupt around the world. But, you know, till these food riots happened, the situation had been getting pretty bad over the last few years. And now when these, you know, we heard of government toppling in Haiti, we have seen, you know, news coming in from Somalia and Senegal and even countries like Indonesia and India. That's when the media really started focusing on what's happening with the food price crisis.
In other words, we separate those two. There's a food crisis, which is whether or not you have the food to eat, and there's a food price crisis, which suddenly gets more attention from the West.
Definitely.
Okay. Let me, if you will, allow me to go through a number of potential factors in both of those crises and just deal with them each briefly, and we'll try to dig down to some of the root causes, okay?
Okay.
What is the role of rising oil prices?
Well, you know, when you look at the current crisis, several factors are being, you know, given out as the reason for the increase in food prices, and one of them is the fuel price increase. Given the kind of industrial agricultural system we have, which is dependent on agrochemical inputs such as chemicals and fertilizers, not to mention the big machinery and the tractors which require fuels, and then the globalization of a food system which requires transporting of food from, you know, one continent to another, that has kicked in, increased costs.
Yeah, so in other words, one of the things that we have this in some ways crazy global food system that was based on transportation being the cheapest link.
Oh, definitely. I mean, you have a food system which is totally upside down and backwards when you have blemish-free grapes coming in from Chile to a place like California, which is a big grower of grapes itself.
Exactly. And when I think the average distance that food travels to get on a plate in America is about 1,500 miles.
That's correct.
And when you factor in all those people who've figured this out and are shopping at farmers markets and so on, it for most people, it's much higher than that. Okay, how about the role of the expanding development of biofuels, the diversion of crops to fuel, where I've talked with Lester Brown for a few years about this, where, you know, basically we end up choosing between putting food in the mouth of a poor person or gas in the tank of a rich person.
Well, definitely. Even the IMF, the International Monetary Fund's World Economic Outlook of 2008, states that nearly half of the food price increase can be blamed onto biofuels, which the civil society, by the way, calls agrofuels. The diversion of food into fuels, as you rightly pointed out, is causing shortage of food grains, and especially for countries such as Mexico and a lot of developing countries whose livelihoods of farmers have been destroyed, whose ability to feed themselves has been destroyed. That basically means when they're dependent on imports from rich nations such as the U.S., and then U.S. decides to divert its food into making biofuels, it increases prices in those countries.
Right. In other words, so the situation of the past 10 or 15 years leading to a certain kind of dependence, and then have the rug pulled out from under you. Okay, so we looked at oil prices, biofuels. Let me read you a quote here. Food trade liberalization in developing countries can hurt attempts to alleviate poverty and damage the environment, according to a report from the International Assessment of Agricultural Science and Technology for Development, whose co-sponsors include the World Bank, the UN's Food and Agriculture Organization, the World Health Organization. They also, in this report which came out recently, said they saw little role for genetically modified foods, as it is currently practiced in feeding the poor on a large scale, and they warned, again, that the global rush to biofuels was not sustainable. Two questions. What is your assessment of their recent report? And then, if you want to expand on in any way on the role of globalization and so-called free trade.
Well, definitely. I think the release of the IASTD report was very timely. And as you pointed out, Terry, the fact it was backed by the World Bank and the other UN organizations is also important. And the report clearly states that the role of economic globalization, free trade policies has been devastating for small farmers. And at the same time states that the answer to dealing with hunger is not in technological solutions such as genetically engineered crops. It is very interesting that this report comes out as the World Trade Organization Chief Pascal Lamy to IMF head Dominique Strauss-Kahn to Robert Zoellick, who was a former USTR and now the head of the World Bank, they are saying that in order to deal with the current food price crisis, we need further trade liberalization.
Right.
We need to conclude the Doha negotiations of the World Trade Organization and remove barriers so food can move freely. Now, it's very interesting that they are prescribing the same solution, which is exactly the reason or the cause of making the third world countries vulnerable in the first place. It is exactly the removal of those tariff barriers, which has resulted in import surges, which has destroyed the ability of nations to focus on local production, focus on small-scale production, support for small farmers. So the policies which have diminished the ability of nations to feed themselves to be food self-sufficient are now being proposed as a solution to the current food price crisis and a complete negation of the report that you just mentioned.
That's right. Their own report, in a sense, says this is the root cause of the problem, and then their prescription for a solution is the same. If it weren't so sad, it would be insane. What is the role of, in other words, you mentioned that what trade liberalization meant to small, to developing countries, and see if I've got this right, is that before, your goal was that your people be able to feed themselves. Or your goal for many of your people was that they be able to feed themselves, and they were able to do so with small growing crops that would feed their family, their village, their town. Then you change the goal to growing cash exportable crops with a different goal in mind. Somehow you'll be fed because the whole economy will rise. And then when that system breaks down, you, as we said before, have no safety net in place. You said what happened was the globalization led to the dropping of tariffs. Mm-hmm. And yet there still remain farm subsidies in rich countries. Explain how that disconnect happened.
Well, we have to understand that before the World Trade Organization and the rest, you had the World Bank and the IMF, who have dictated policies to the third world countries, which resulted in removal of any kind of subsidies to farmers, any kind of social safety net, such as, you know, public distribution system or rural work program schemes in countries such as India. And at the same time, it led to elimination of state in agriculture. So you had grain marketing boards, which used to ensure fixed prices to the farmers, fixed prices to consumers. All of those were dismantled because market was supposed to take care of it all. And then came in the trade agreements, which were supposed to create a level playing field. And as you mentioned, Terry, we have the rich nations such as the U.S., where agribusinesses are armed with these huge subsidies. We're talking about billions of dollars. And they can then grow and dump products at below the cost of production because the campesina in Mexico or elsewhere does not have the subsidies which were already removed. So there's no way a farmer in Indonesia or in some African nation can compete against these giant agribusinesses in the rich nations. So the result is that because they're dumping at below the cost of production, they have been able to capture markets around the world. And the net result is that the farmers in third world countries have been displaced. And instead, the third world countries have been told to focus on cash crops, you know, coffee, mm-hmm. cocoa, bananas, and even flowers. So you would find tulips and roses and others are being grown in countries such as Colombia or Kenya and India instead of resources being used to grow food for their own people. So when that has happened and U.S. and others decide that we are going to divert our food to, say, you know, our corn into ethanol, suddenly the prices increase for third world communities and they're dependent on these imports and they're unable to feed their own people. And then we find myths such as it is the increased demand from countries such as India. In fact, when you look at data, you find that since India adopted new economic policies which were based on privatization, deregulation, privatization, you find that actually nutritional levels of people have declined and have gone back to the era before the implementation of Green Revolution in India, that is in the 1950s. So it is not the increased demand from emerging economies. It is really an agricultural system which has turned our food into commodities.
Wow. I mean, it strikes me. India, if I'm not mistaken, is home to nearly 50% of the world's most hungry, correct? And yet at the same time, in some part of that country, there's a thriving, expanding, tech-oriented middle class.
Exactly. You have a country which is the third largest agricultural producer in the world. It is a country where we keep hearing about from Condoleezza Rice and President Bush about increasing demand. There are about 70,000 people earning over $250,000 a year. There is a thriving middle class, which is about, you know, 250,000 million.
In other words, people just to get the scale of that, the middle class in India is, you know, nearly as large as the entire population of the U.S.
But what we are forgetting, Terry, is it is a country of a billion people.
Right.
And out of that, only 250 million can be the middle class. But the majority of people are living below the poverty line. And as you mentioned, India is home to the world's nearly 50% of the world's hungry population. So given that situation, you have a country where agricultural land is being replaced into special economic zones because agriculture is no longer profitable as we find dumping of cheap subsidized commodities. So agricultural land is being converted into areas where call centers and others are being placed. We have lost the ability to feed our own people.
Oh, well, that's so tragic. There's another thing, which while we're pointing out this paradox in India, the connection between a billion people overweight in the world and, as you pointed out, 850 million people starving. Mm-hmm. What's the connection there?
Sorry, could you repeat that question? I didn't quite get it.
The connection between the fact that at one moment in time, we have a billion people obese, overweight, and 850 million starving.
Well, I would say they're both symptoms of malnutrition. They're both symptoms of a failed agricultural and food system. So on one hand, obesity is not a sign of prosperity. It is basically a symbol and a symptom of an agricultural food system having gone completely berserk, where we consider it cheap to go and eat at McDonald's when the food prices increase. You know, a lot of low-income communities right here in the United States who have to make a tough choice between having a roof over their head or food on the table will be forced to make food choices based on what they can afford to buy. So this is really a wake-up call for us to take back a food system, to challenge those policies which have created this widespread hunger, because this is not just about what's happening to farmers in faraway distant lands, but this is really about what's happening to the food system in the United States itself and about our human right to healthy and nutritious food right here in the U.S.
I recently interviewed Michael Pollan about his book In Defense of Food, Ann Cooper about her work with the Berkeley School System, and I've been looking in researching for this interview with you, Arunada, at Raj Patel's new book. I'm forgetting the title right now, but how do their critiques and recommendations fit with the bigger picture of what you've just laid out? In other words, they're pointing out some of the same symptoms, but it looks like they say, well, now's the time to take advantage of those farmers' markets. Now's the time to get out of the supermarket and so on. Does that ignore in this country, just as they are ignored in India, the poorest?
Well, a couple of things. One is, yes, it is very important for us to reconnect with the food system. It is very important for us to know who grows our food and how it is grown. So I could not overemphasize the importance of farmers' markets. But we have to also acknowledge the fact that in our low-income communities, that in our urban sprawls, we have these food deserts where communities have no access to a place where they can buy the healthy, nutritious food. So it is we have to link this to the issue of social economic justice. As long as our food stamps will be around $21 per week, we have to ensure that low-income communities can buy enough for their families, can buy healthy, nutritious foods. So I think it is a little simplistic to say that because of this crisis, now everyone would rush out to the farmers' markets and buy there. The truth is that the inflation rate is going through the sky. There is no living wage in this country. People are not, forget about a living wage. The minimum wage is huge, is very minimum. And more than 39 million Americans are living below the poverty line. And the way the poverty line is calculated is very misleading. The figures would be much higher. So we have to start looking at the larger picture and start demanding a more equitable America, because still we have those equitable policies and economic policies that would create a fair America. We will not see that change in the rest of the world. It is time to start talking about living wage. It is time to start talking about land reform and true agrarian reforms. So, yes, farmers' markets, community-supported agriculture are a piece of the problem, but they're a very teeny-tiny part of it, and we have to have the larger perspective to it.
In other words, for some people, there isn't access to that. I don't know whether it was in reading your work or, as I said, Patel's, that there are some people that work so hard just to be able to survive that they don't have the time to take advantage of what is now available that didn't used to be, and in fact stopping at a McDonald's where you eat it in the car on your way between your two jobs may be, to some extent, all that's left for you. You have said that hunger is not caused by a shortage of food, and that the fact that hunger is caused instead by socioeconomic policies is good news. How so, and what can listeners do?
Well, I'd say it is good news, because once we realize that hunger is not a result of some supernatural cause that is beyond our control, we basically realize that hunger is not just a shortage of food production. It is really a shortage of purchasing power, or you would not have you know, United States of America, one of the richest countries in the world, have nearly 36 to 39 million Americans being considered food insecure by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And we realize it is the absence of jobs that provide dignity, that ensure our human dignity and provide a living wage. We know that we can end hunger. It's similarly in third world countries such as India, which is, you know, if you look at its agricultural trade balance, even as, you know, it is home to nearly half of the world's hungry population, its agricultural trade balance is positive. That means it is exporting more than it imports. So we know we can change those policies that would ensure food for all and healthy, nutritious food for all. We know that we can have policies which do not see food as commodities to be traded in international market. We can make food once again about feeding our families and communities. It does not have to be about monocultures. It can be about biodiversity. We can replace those industrial corporate farms by the family farms. So this is really about social economic policies, and we can exercise our power as citizens wherever we are. I mean, right now, because of the food price crisis, people have taken to the streets. The result has been all the policies that third world countries were told to give up, for example, Indonesia, is now implementing food subsidies worth $207 million. Countries like India, Vietnam, Niger, and many others are imposing export controls to meet domestic needs. So when people rise up and stand up and demand justice and food for their families, we see change despite pressure from international financial institutions.
I hear what you're saying. In other words, they gave up certain things to get loans and so on, and they bought the, or at least the leaders bought the that vision, and that now the crisis has hit a point where they're saying they're taking back their rights to do things the way that work for their own people. If I gave you 1 minute, basically, one issue that we've left out of this conversation is U.S. food aid. And the way that we do it in a way that may not only be not as helpful as it could be, but may in fact be harmful. If you could give a 1 minute assessment of that, then I'll have to move to a close.
Definitely, yes. In terms of food aid, unfortunately, it's been another way of dumping U.S. surpluses in third world markets and capturing markets in those countries. So it is very important that U.S. follows European Union and other industrialized nations. And if it means to provide aid, it should be given as cash and should be used to buy food, which is grown locally and regionally by small farmers.
In other words, the way the system of U.S. farm aid works now is that we pass a bill that says we're going to provide this much food aid to poor countries, and then what we say is it has to be bought, packaged in the U.S., and shipped to those countries. And, of course, the cost that we could maybe get that food for in that country, where that how far that money would go to help people, would go much further and be much more efficiently spent if it were spent on the ground in the other country.
Well, it doubles the cost, basically, by the fact that we buy it and package it and ship it from here. We can cut it into half our food aid budget and yet be able to buy the same amount if we bought it locally.
Excellent. Or we could help twice as many people with the same amount of money.
Exactly.
So, as you can see, this is the food crisis is an interconnected crisis in the world right now. So again, you can learn more at the oaklandinstitute.org. Thank you, Arunata Mittal. Keep up the good work.